What about all these measles and mumps cases?
Blood pressure lowering medications and the risk of fractures.
What are some of the outcomes following LASIX?
And repairing aortic aneurysms in the U.S. and on the other side of the pond.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on November 25th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I have to say that I am so almost completely astonished that in our 11 years now, happy anniversary of recording, we have never talked about outcomes from LASIK surgery. That's in JAMA Ophthalmology.
You're right, Elizabeth. In our 11 years, happy anniversary and happy Thanksgiving, we've not talked about laser in situ keratomeliosis, which is called LASIK surgery for the eye, to correct a number of visual problems. We know it's been around for many years and it's been very effective, but we have little data on individual satisfaction with the results. So these investigators combined two studies. These were prospective observational studies from 2011 to 2014, in which they examined almost 600 individuals that had LASIK surgery and provided questionnaires afterwards. And the questionnaires were provided at 1, 3, and 6 months after the procedure to ascertain whether they were satisfied and whether they had complications or symptoms related to the LASIK surgery, symptoms being primarily double images or glare or halos or what people described as starburst. And what they discovered was that about a fourth of individuals complain of dry eyes. This is the fourth of individuals that did not have dry eyes before their procedures. A substantial number of individuals complain of the visual symptoms, and 1 to 4% say they were unsatisfied with the results. These visual symptoms actually impaired or interfered with their daily activities.
I thought that this was somewhat surprising, at least to me, because I do not recall us ever talking about the prospective studies relative to this procedure. How often are these people apprised of these possibilities beforehand?
The point's well taken. Many times, the side effects are minimized. And the interesting thing about this particular study was when they compared the questionnaire, which was self-administered over the web, individuals were 3 or 4 times more likely to complain about the results than they were to their physicians. I think we need to adequately counsel individuals, not only about what the upsides are, but what the possible side effects are related to this procedure as well.
I think that, and I think you've put your finger on a really provocative point, which is maybe all of those kinds of questionnaires about patient satisfaction ought to be administered in an anonymous or a separated way so that the patient doesn't feel that they're going to compromise their relationship with the physician.
That's an excellent point. People could be at their home thinking about it. Gosh, do I have side effects? Am I pleased or not pleased with it?
Let's turn from here then. We're going to consider two together. This week, there's been some reporting of mumps and measles recurrence among specific populations. One was a study in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and the other, MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality, weekly report from the CDC.
These tie together very nicely. The report from the CDC is that we're having a mumps outbreak across the United States. Compared to last year, we have 3 times as many mumps cases being reported this year as last year. That amounts to about 3,000 cases reported already, as opposed to about 1,000 last year. The interesting thing about it is the mumps outbreaks seems to be centered primarily in colleges. Now, the follow-up on the PNAS paper looked not at mumps, but looked at measles, another disease transmitted by a virus. And what it determined was that the transmission within schools is much higher than it is in the general population, and much higher than previously considered. We're always concerned whether people who attend school are vaccinated appropriately, but even, for example, for mumps, it's not 100% effective. If people have gotten the recommended 2 mumps vaccinations, it's about 88% effective. They've only received 1 of the 2, it's about 78% effective. But in the school setting, you have much closer contact. You're much more likely to be exchanging saliva either through kissing or drinking from the same glass. The important, I think, take-home message is we need to be aware of whether we are appropriately vaccinated, and we need to be aware of proper sanitation and hygiene.
And this is a really important public health issue, I think. We've talked about this before. As people age, their immunity, of course, starts to wane, and they become the people who are at risk for developing these viral illnesses. I'm wondering if you think there's a place for revaccination for folks as they get older, almost irrespective of whether their antibody titer suggests they're protected.
We've certainly shown that for pertussis or whooping cough. We do the same thing for tetanus, and it makes sense we should do the same thing for mumps and measles. As we age, our immunity ages, and for these transmissible diseases, we need to be up to date with re-immunization.
Okay. Let's turn then from here to something I thought was just an amazing paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, a comparison of the standards of care for abdominal aortic aneurysm and outcomes.
Abdominal aortic aneurysm is a situation where there's a weakness in the wall of the aorta, and the aorta begins to enlarge or bulge. That's the aneurysm. And when it gets to a certain size, it increases the risk that it could spontaneously, acutely rupture. And that is a life-threatening condition. So the recommendations are, at a certain size, the abdominal aortic aneurysm should be repaired electively, either with surgery or using some of the stents called endovascular repair. What this study did was it looked at the thresholds for abdominal aortic aneurysm repair in England and the United States, recognized that the thresholds differed. That is, they were more likely to wait for it to get larger in the United Kingdom than in the U.S. Well, the real question is, does that affect outcome? Does waiting a little bit longer predispose the individuals to having rupture and increase the risk of death related to the aneurysm? So they examined the period from 2005 to 2012, in which case about 29,000 patients in England and about 278,000 patients in the United States underwent repair, elective repair, of the abdominal aortic aneurysm. What they discovered was repair was less likely in the United Kingdom than in the United States, about 50% less likely. Aneurysm-related death was more common in the United Kingdom. It was about 4 times more common. And hospitalization due to rupture was about 2.5 times more common. So in this particular case, the lower rate of repair in the United Kingdom most likely contributed to the increased risk for hospitalization related to rupture and an increased risk of death as well.
I find this really interesting because so many of these comparison studies comparing the care that's received here versus that in the UK or in Canada, for that matter, where there are single-payer systems, often find us wanting in quality of life measures, and sometimes in outcomes. And so I thought this was really cool because it validated the care that's received here.
You're right. I mean, there are many things that if you delay care, it doesn't really necessarily affect mortality. If you delay a hip replacement or a knee replacement. So this was a terrific study. I'm glad you picked it.
Let us review then that men, and particularly men who smoke, are at higher risk for this. And hey, folks, it's just really easy to get screened for it.
Every individual that smokes should have, after the age of 50, an image of their abdominal aorta. There's a family history of it. Those individuals should be screened as well.
Let's finally then turn to JAMA Internal Medicine, a problem, a potential problem that affects literally millions of people, not just domestically, but worldwide. What are the risks of some hypertension medicines?
Both hypertension and fractures from osteoporosis are more likely to occur in older individuals. In some observational studies that have looked at blood pressure lowering medications, it has been suggested that some of the less expensive but effective ones, that is the thiazide diuretics, can actually be associated with lower risk of osteoporotic fractures. These authors decided to look at randomized controlled trials looking at different medications, thiazide diuretics to calcium channel blockers to ACE inhibitors. They had over 22,000 individuals that were randomized to one of these three medications, and they followed them looking at outcomes with respect to cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and stroke. They also recorded whether they had fractures. What they discovered, those that received the thiazides were about 21% lower risk of having fractures compared to the other two medications. It looked like there was a more substantial difference between thiazide and the ACE inhibitor than thiazide than the calcium channel blocker.
And of course, we know that the first line is the diuretic for the treatment of hypertension.
And the reason for that in many individuals is that it is relatively inexpensive, in fact, the least expensive. It's associated with few side effects, but not everybody can tolerate it. And there are some things one has to look out for example, reduced potassium, oftentimes need to be replaced. Since these diseases track together, hypertension and osteoporosis, it's nice to be able to choose a medication to treat hypertension that doesn't increase the risk of osteoporosis.
Right, exactly. Because, gosh, we know what the data are. They're just awful on hip fracture and subsequent either replacement or having to be in a long-term care facility and death.
And those hip fractures can result either from the medication accelerating osteoporosis or, on the flip side, delaying its progression, or also over-aggressive antihypertensive therapy, which can lower someone's blood pressure, make them dizzy or lightheaded, and cause them to fall as well. So that needs to be considered too.
Very good. On that note, I'm going to talk about the paper, of course, on the treatment of abdominal aortic aneurysm in the New England Journal of Medicine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Happy Thanksgiving, and y'all live well.